Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the president's red line with Syria, which may have been crossed with a limited use of the chemical weapon sarin. A former UN Special Commission Chemical and Biologicals Weapons Inspector in Iraq, Raymond Zelinskis, who directs the Chemical and Biological Weapons Nonproliferation Program at the Monterey Institute for International Studies, joins us. We will discuss UN efforts to get a team of inspectors into Syria that the Assads are blocking and what might be done to secure Syria's substantial WMD arsenal from use by either the regime or the rebels. Then we'll look into the historical legacy of George W. Bush that his former spokesperson and Fox News pundits are now revising to suggest that Bush kept us safe from terrorists while Obama did not. Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, Secretary of State Colin Powell's Chief of Staff, who served in the Bush White House, joins us to discuss the glaring omission of 9/11 from this latest revisionist history and how much Bush and Cheney are helped by the 9/11 truthers propagating conspiracy theories shared by the Boston bombers that served to cover up Bush and Cheney's reckless endangerment of the United States for failing to prevent 9/11. Then finally, we'll be joined by Joan Walsh, editor-at-large of Salon.com and an MSNBC analyst. She is the author of a new book just out in paperback, What's the Matter with White People? Finding Our Way in the Next America. We will discuss the domination of our politics by a minority of angry white men who have prevented sensible gun safety measures that 90% of Americans favor, and what can be done to restore majority rule in the United States government. Joining us now is Raymond Zelinskis, who directs the Chemical and Biological Weapons Nonproliferation Program at the James Martin Center for Nonproliferation Studies with the Monterey Institute for International Studies. He is a senior investigator at the Preparedness and Emergency Response Research Center component at the Center for Nonproliferation Studies, which is working in partnership with the Center for Infectious Diseases and Emergency Readiness at the School of Public Health at the University of California at Berkeley. He is a former United Nations Special Commission Chemical and Biological Inspector in Iraq and is the author of Biological Warfare, Modern Offense and Defense. And his new book, co-written with Milton Leitenberg, is The Soviet Biological Weapons Program, A History. Welcome to Background Briefing, Raymond Zelinskis.
Pleasure to be with you again. Yeah.
And there's clearly a lot of focus now on Syria and reports that there have been a limited use of chemical weapons, I think. Sarin is what is being cited here. Obviously, the president had earlier talked about the use of chemical weapons by the Assad regime would be crossing a red line. And some analysts suggest the president may have essentially put himself in a situation where he's really got to act on his, you know, in other words, he's got to call his own bluff. So that has caused the president to sort of back down a little bit and wait for some more information. And the more information would presumably come from the UN team, the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons. They're a group of inspectors working for the United Nations. At this point, they're waiting to go in and check to see whether there's any real evidence here. But Syria seems to be blocking the mission. The mission, of course, is led by a Swedish scientist, Åke Sällström. So what's your understanding of this standoff?
Well, first of all, the team that's waiting to get in, and it is being sent by the UN Secretary General. They want freedom of action to conduct their investigation, but the Syrians, with the support of Russia, would only allow them to go to Aleppo investigate that one event, which happened maybe now about 3 weeks ago. The latest supposed use of chemical weapons by the Syrian government that the United States has said might have happened is probably not going to be investigated by this team. So it's completely two different events. One that is investigatable, shall we say, by the UN team, and one that we still are up in the air about, and whether or not it can be investigated.
So when the Syrians say that they don't trust the team because it has some Americans and Britons on it, even though my understanding is it's largely scientists from other countries, 15 of them, and including analytical chemists from the World Health Organization, led, of course, by the Swedish scientists that I mentioned, that's the standoff. I mean, you served as a UN weapons inspector in Iraq. Aren't these teams pretty independent? They're operating under the UN. They're not operating because of the nationalities of the members.
That's true. The Iraqis had somewhat of the same situation with the UNSCOM teams, which I was a member of twice. And that was that they did not like the Americans to be on these teams. And that was eventually settled by the UNSCOM being dissolved and a new organization being set up that was a UN organization called UNMOVIC. And that one hired people from all over the world. And their primary loyalty was to the United Nations, not to the countries where they come from. Now, I must say that this team that's being assembled is an ad hoc team, as far as I know anyway, and they're not hired by the United Nations. Now, some of them come from the OPCW, the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, which is headquartered in The Hague, Netherlands, and that is an international organization with inspectors that whose first loyalty is to the OPCW. So I think that the team right now, as far as I know it, would be the proper one to actually mount the investigation.
Well, they're apparently standing by in Cyprus, ready to go in. Now, Ray Zelinskas, again, he directs the Chemical and Biological Weapons Nonproliferation Program at the Monterey Institute for International Studies, and he's a former United Nations Special Commission Chemical and Biological Inspector in Iraq and the author of a new book co-written with Milton Leitenberg, The Soviet Biological Weapons Program, A History. So when the president recently, speaking with King Abdullah of Jordan, said we have varying degrees of confidence about the actual use. There's a range of questions about how and when these weapons have been used. And the president then went on to insist on a vigorous investigation, and the proof of the use of chemical weapons would be a game changer. So clearly the president's hedging in the sense that he's not suggesting that the red line that he talked about earlier is being crossed. But, I mean, the U.S.'s options don't look particularly good, do they? I mean, I understand there's a special forces team in Jordan near the border there training Jordanians for the possible interdiction of going in there and trying to secure these chemical weapons. But wouldn't that be a really difficult job? I mean, I guess that in many ways was what was going on in Iraq.
Well, there's a little difference again. The Jordanian team, as far as I know, and all of this is classified, by the way, you know, the real details, but the Jordanian team wouldn't go in to do an inspection, an investigation. They would go in to secure a site,
which is quite different. Right. Now, that's what they're doing, and that's the question I have, because a lot of the so-called intelligence on this is coming from the Israelis, which are based on photographs. So there are two issues here. One, to verify whether the red line is being crossed, and then two, what would be done in the event that the red line was crossed. So let's not confuse it. Start with the first one. The evidence so far, to your mind, Ray Zelinskas, is not sufficient to believe that the red line is being crossed. Is that right?
That's right. I agree with you that the main evidence seems to come from photographs and by the Israelis. And what they're saying is that the symptoms of mostly dead animals are suggestive or they say indicative of a nerve agent attack. The main signs being a drooling, an obvious drooling of around the mouth and nasal passages. And the second one of being something called meiosis, in other words, pinprick pupils. Now, it is true that these are indeed signs of nerve agent poisoning, but they're also a sign of organophosphorus pesticide poisonings. So I want to make sure that unless you have samples, you really can't tell the difference. You cannot tell the difference from photos. And I don't know how the Israelis can have such fine photos that tells them that indeed there are, that the pupils are pinprick rather than normal size. But that's, again, these are classified information, I guess.
But sarin itself was developed by German scientists and Hitler stockpiled it during World War II. Apparently, it's extremely dangerous to manufacture and requires sophisticated equipment, and it contains four major ingredients, include phosphorus trichloride. Where did the Syrians get their information and know-how and precursors to make their chemical weapons program, which I believe ranges in the tons of or hundreds of tons of materials?
Yes. Well, undoubtedly, they have a pesticide industry. They have a chemical industry that can deal with some of these very toxic agents. Also, the question is whether or not the Iranians have provided them with information. The Iranians set up a chemical weapons program during the Iran-Iraq War that lasted between 1980 and 1988. And then there's also the question whether or not some of the Iraqi scientists or technicians escaped to Syria with some knowledge. And also there's this very odd event that's not fully known about the Russian general. His name is Kuznetsov, who was head of the agency in Europe in Russia that dealt with chemical and biological weapons issues. So he was fired from his job by Yeltsin because he apparently sold secrets or even the agents itself to Syria. And that whole episode is still very murky. So we have, you know, all kinds of mysteries going on exactly how were the elements of a Syrian weapons, chemical weapons program assembled and operated.
But given the fact that they may well have, a Russian general may well have passed on Soviet classified material on their chemical program, what about the Soviet biological program, which you've written about with Milton Leitenberg in your new book, a very hefty book, I might add, The Soviet Biological Weapons Program, A History? I did some research on that some time ago with Ken Ellerbeck, who was the deputy director of Biopreparat, which was the cover for this vast program. And the real guy in charge, of course, is General Kalinin. And he's still around, is he not?
Yes.
And he's still an influential guy.
Yes, he's a consultant to the Biopreparat system as it exists today in Moscow. And by the way, please let me correct the name of the Russian general that I just mentioned. His name is Kuznetsov. So it's anyway, but yes, but you can't link that to Syria or any other program. The Soviets were extremely secretive about its biological weapons program, to the point where even their allies, the East Germans and the Czechs and the Poles, none of them knew anything about their offensive program. They knew something about their defensive program because they had training exercises and such, but nothing about their very, very large and very, very sophisticated offensive biological weapons program.
And more to the point, the U.S. didn't know about it, and the Russians had signed the treaty going back to the Nixon era, and there was even a use of anthrax deaths in Sverdlovsk, which at the time was the Communist Party leader there was Boris Yeltsin, and they had a factory right in the middle of the town that was making biological weapons, anthrax, and a lot of people died, but essentially the West believed the cover story, didn't they?
That's right. They did for a long time. The cover story being that it was a natural outbreak, essentially caused by a farmer bringing in an infected animal to Sverdlovsk, butchering it, and then selling the contaminated meat. But it was very clear that it was not a gastrointestinal form of anthrax that affected the population of Sverdlovsk. It was inhalation anthrax, and that, as you mentioned, came from a factory that was set up some years before that by the military to produce not only Bacillus anthracis spores, but also other biological weapons agents. And as the city grew, it came to surround that factory, but they just kept working along. And then they had this accident in 1979 with up to about 200 people, with about 60 to 80 people that died. And after that, they closed it down very rapidly and moved it to another area and eventually set up another production plant in Kazakhstan in a place called Stepnogorsk.
So, but just to finish up on this, there is no evidence that there's evidence that the Soviet chemical weapons program was transferred, elements of it were transferred to Syria, but not the bio. They've been very, very scrupulous about that, have they not?
That's right. Nothing. But their biology program, there was this issue whether or not the Soviets had supplied Iraq with smallpox virus, but that was not the case. That was did not happen at all.
So, and the only two countries that have the variola smallpox are the U.S. and Russia, right?
That's right, officially, anyway.
Officially, and that is a hideous thought that that could ever get loose. Let's go back then to where do you think, Raymond Zelinskas, this situation with Syria will go, given the importance of it, because it is essentially, it could be the trigger for U.S. and NATO intervention in this war in Syria. What do you think is likely to happen?
Well, I don't really have a good crystal ball on this. I can only, my gut feeling is that eventually the pressure would be on the Syrian government to allow the UN inspectors to go in into the preliminary investigation. But that it's not. That's only going to, like I said, deal with one event. This whole new event of. Of a small, what they call small-scale use of nerve agent by the Syrians is yet to be settled.
Now, do you think some analysts say that the Syrians deliberately did this small-scale use to test the red line? Does that make sense to you?
No, it doesn't.
It doesn't make sense to me either. But the bottom line here is that they have tons of this stuff, and the real scare would be. If the rebels got it, you've got these al-Nusra people that are allied to the so-called al-Qaeda in Iraq, and they're, you know, they're not even a trained military for all the deficiencies and brutality of the Syrian military. These guys are really like something out of Mad Max.
That's right. Well, something I worry about, I just keep in the back of my mind, is that one of these fanatic groups that are... or allied somehow with the Al-Qaeda, will end up using either an organophosphorus pesticide or maybe you'll be able to secure the chemical agent somehow in Iraq and then use it in such a way that the international community thinks that the Assad government used it. And that then would trigger off this red line threat of the Westerners going into Syria, and then we're into another kind of Libya, Egypt, Iraq situation, which I certainly hope does not happen. I mean, what we really need is an international effort to investigate these events, and if indeed chemical weapons have been used, then a UN force should really should be sent in, not an American force.
Well, you know, there's pressure, of course, from John McCain, who's just been to the Syrian border in a refugee camp in neighboring Jordan, talking about how the refugees are bitter and want to take revenge, and they're bitter at the Americans for not helping them. And, of course, he's beating the drum for an intervention and has been for some time. And we can be very suspicious of the Israelis' motives as well, but I think just in closing, Ray Zelinskas, it does seem that there are a lot of people out there that are trying to push the U.S. into a war.
Well, I don't understand that. What kind of lessons do we draw from having been in Iraq and in Afghanistan?
And Libya, which is more to the point, which is in total chaos.
Yes, all of them. And if it's going to be an intervention, it has to be by the international community, not by the United States.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Raymond Zelinskas.
Pleasure, Ion. Thanks for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Raymond Zielinskas, who directs the Chemical and Biological Weapons Nonproliferation Program at the James Martin Center for Nonproliferation Studies with the Monterey Institute for International Studies. He's a senior investigator at the Preparedness and Emergency Response Research Center component at the Center for Nonproliferation Studies, which is working in partnership with the Center for Infectious Diseases and the Emergency Readiness at the School of Public Health, University of California, Berkeley. He's a former United Nations Special Commission Chemical and Biological Weapons Inspector in Iraq and is the author of Biological Warfare, Modern Offense and Defense. And his new book, co-written with Milton Leichenberg, is The Soviet Biological Weapons Program, A History. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking with a senior official who served at the highest levels in George W. Bush's White House, and we'll talk about Bush's legacy. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Lawrence Wilkerson, who's a retired United States Army colonel and former chief of staff to United States Secretary of State Colin Powell. In 2005, he went public with his knowledge that Vice President Cheney had provided the guidance that led to America's torture disgrace in Guantanamo, Abu Ghraib, and elsewhere. Currently, he teaches courses at the College of William & Mary and George Washington University. Welcome to Background Briefing, Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson.
Thanks, Ian. Glad to be with you.
And if you and Colin Powell were in the Obama White House, what advice would you be giving him about this red line over Syria and the possible use of the chemical weapon sarin, given the chaos that is already in Libya from that intervention and clearly an intervention in I think we're heading for even more chaos in Syria?
I would personally be very, very careful about what anybody in the intelligence community tells you, Mr. President. And second, I would say, think about it from a strategic point of view. Put yourself in Bashar al-Assad's shoes and just ask yourself, would this man, under the circumstances he now is involved in, even think about using chemical weapons? This is an absurdity that's been made even bigger by the fact that people are blowing it out of proportion. I would guess at this point that it's either a false flag operation by the Israelis or by someone else with a vested interest in taking Assad out. I would have no belief whatsoever in anyone who told me that Bashar al-Assad was stupid enough to use chemical weapons against his own people.
Of course, the evidence is based upon Israeli photographs, and our previous guest, Iraq UN Special Weapons Inspector, said that's absolutely ridiculous to base evidence on photographs.
And as I understand it from my contacts in the intelligence community, whom I respect and still listen to, this has something to do with blood samples. There is a chain of evidence that no one can corroborate other than the Israelis. And with those conditions alone, if I were the Secretary of Defense or the President, I'd throw it out. I wouldn't even consider it. Move on to the next point.
Well, if that's the case, then this must be in the context of Israel's apparent determination, or at least the Netanyahu government's determination, to get United States to get into a war with Iran, which they've been pushing for, about 2 years now.
I think that's the case. I think Lindsey Graham, John McCain, Bob Menendez on the Democratic side, they're all in cahoots with this effort. I think they see Syria as a back door into Iran because Iran is providing substantial support to Assad. They almost have to because we have forced Damascus and Tehran into this really unholy alliance. They would not normally be friends. We've forced them into what they're doing together. That said, I don't believe that we're looking at any possibility, in the near future anyway, that U.S. forces bombing clandestine boots on the ground could ameliorate the situation in Syria at all, as some of my colleagues are trying to encourage me to be for. I think all we could do is exacerbate it and make it even worse, and as you said, open the door for those who would ultimately look at Tehran as the target and not Damascus.
And again, I'm speaking with Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, retired U.S. Army Colonel, former Chief of Staff to United States Secretary of State Colin Powell. He now teaches courses at the College of William and Mary and George Washington University. The this week, of course, was the opening of the Bush Presidential Library in Dallas, Texas, attended by the five living presidents. At this point, there's an effort of revisionist history going on with George W. Bush's former spokesperson, Dana Perino, and Fox News pundits revising history to suggest that Bush kept us safe from terrorists while Obama did not. And the extraordinary thing is this glaring omission of 9/11 from this latest revisionist history. So what do you make of that?
Well, I was out in Dallas when they had the ceremonial opening with all the presidents in attendance, and I listened to Bush say something, I could almost quote him, that just blew me off my feet. He said, "I want people to come to this library and see that we lived up to our convictions." Just the week before, I had heard the Constitution Project's Task Force on Detainee Treatment, including people like Asa Hutchinson from the Republican Party, Tom Pickering, other reputable people, tell me that in a two-year study they had concluded, one, we did torture. Two, it was authorized at the highest levels of the land, read vice president and president. So how in the world can the former president stand there in front of that library and in good conscience say that he wants people to come in and see that we lived up to our convictions? Mr. President, you no more lived up to our convictions than Attila the Hun.
Well, do you think that any of these officials, Bush, Cheney, et cetera, Wolfowitz, do they recognize the systemic and widespread and continuing danger that crossing this line has done to U.S. foreign policy and to U.S. standing? For example, in the Magnitsky affair, where the U.S. are objecting to the Russian treatment of human rights treatment of an official who was murdered, even though he's a whistleblower, he died in prison, even though he's a whistleblower, they put him in prison instead of the crooks. And Putin's response to that is, well, you know, you guys torture in Guantanamo. So every dictator on the planet has that comeback.
They certainly do. It's hurt our reputation across the world. And unlike Moscow or Beijing or even Brasilia or New Delhi, our reputation is a real part of our actual power. When you diminish our reputation, you diminish our power. And that's what's happened all across the globe. I talk to diplomats in Beijing, in Moscow, and elsewhere who say what you just said. We're hypocrites. Putin's even suggested getting a state sponsors of terrorism list going in Moscow and putting the United States at the top. The sad thing is there's some rationale for that. We've done nothing but hurt ourselves, and I've got to say, and we're continuing to hurt ourselves dramatically with this increased drone use around the world, where we are taking it to the terrorist, if you will. And what we're doing, it in many cases, is taking it to innocent civilians. And what this is doing is further eroding our reputation. Not only that, it's also setting a precedent that has no international law, no national law, nothing associated with it, no ethical code. We are leading the world in this technology, and we're acting as if it's something that's gleefully to be used. We're doing enormous damage to our reputation, and we're creating more terrorists in the process.
Well, it's pretty clear in retrospect, is it not, Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, that Bush and Cheney riled up a billion Muslims. This rage over drones, it looks as if it could become blowback and that we could be enduring attacks like the Boston bombers attacks for decades to come. You know, asymmetrical warfare is the warfare of the moment, and it will be for some time. The weak strike back against the strong, with whatever means they can get their hands on. Do you think that that it's this is blowback from riling up all of these this entire religion, which Bush and Cheney,
I think you're right. I think Akbar Ahmed, professor at American University and a leading world anthropologist, is right when he says we're aiding now, in the name of counterterrorism, all these authoritarian central governments to essentially fight their peripheries. And we're doing it with drones. And these drone strikes are not something that's just going after terrorists. They're going after innocent civilians, too. You have places in Pakistan right now where people won't even go to funerals or go to weddings because they're so frightened to look up and see a rocket coming down and killing them. So this is not increasing our security. It's decreasing it. And furthermore, more people die on the highways in the United States every year than have died in the entire history of terrorist attacks. So what are we doing this for? That's a huge question that Americans simply aren't asking. What are we doing this for?
Sure, and every day in America, there are 15 deaths from workplace accidents, and we saw what happened down in Texas. But let me ask you, Colonel.
Incidentally, Ian, what happened in Texas, I'm hearing from government contacts, has a lot to do with the shredding of the regulatory agencies that Dick Cheney did when he was vice president. There was not the kind of regulation vis-a-vis explosives and ammunition factories and so forth that there should be, because Dick Cheney eviscerated it while he was in office.
Well, let's talk about what last time we spoke at the very end, you mentioned to me, given the revisionism going on from Bush surrogates and Fox News pundits, that Bush kept us safe from terrorists and Obama didn't because of the Boston bombing and this huge omission of 9/11. You were saying that what you think haunts Bush and Cheney is that their reckless endangerment of the United States prior to 9/11, and that they even expected to be impeached at the time.
I think there's some truth to that. I think Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld got lost, we now know. 9/11 Commission tried to hide this, did a very clever job of hiding it. They got lost for at least 35 minutes post-9/11, post the strikes. No one could find them. Dick Cheney lied to the 9/11 Commission about this and about other matters. The 9/11 Commission, to a certain extent, was a whitewash in that respect. We still don't know exactly what happened in that 30 to 35 minutes, but we do know that Flight 93, had it completed its mission and hit the White House, could have probably been stopped had Cheney not been lost somewhere and given the order to the pilots who were flying over Washington at that time to shoot that airplane down. He claimed he did. He did not. Not in time. So this is something that still needs looking into. It won't get looked into because in the United States, we do not do these sorts of things.
Well, isn't that one of the problems? First of all, the inquiries were whitewashed. But then you've got this bizarre phenomenon of the 9/11 truthers propagating conspiracy theories that incidentally were shared by the Boston bombers and their mother. And the best way to discredit and muddy the waters is to give it to the conspiracy theories and the nutcases, and then nobody wants to touch it. And that seems to be the problem here, that in a curious way, the conspiracy theorists are serving as cover-ups for Bush and Cheney's reckless endangerment for failing to prevent 9/11.
You're right. Usually the lies that are told, whether they're told by conspiracy theorists or people in government trying to cover up their own errors, do that sort of thing. The old adage about the truth shall make you free has some resonance and some accuracy to it. And we just don't have the truth.
So tell me, I don't know whether you've seen, Colonel Wilkinson, the video that's gone viral. Millions of people around the world have seen it of a young paralyzed Iraq war veteran, Thomas Young, who is essentially committing suicide. He's in so much pain that he's decided not to continue his suffering. And he's written an open letter to Dick Cheney and Don Rumsfeld and George Bush saying, in terms of George Bush, he says that I think Bush was manipulated by Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld and Paul Wolfowitz. But just quoting from his letter, you sent us to fight and die in Iraq after you, Mr. Cheney, dodged the draft in Vietnam, and you, Mr. Bush, went AWOL from your National Guard unit. Do you think that a powerful message like this from somebody that did serve his country, apparently he signed up after 9/11, yet we have all of this, well, you were saying earlier in Dallas now, it's all, you know, no apologies. Both Bush and Cheney have said effectively that they've tortured, and they're proud of it.
Powerful, powerful story that young man tells. I was at Project Healing Waters fly fishing event last night down in Syria, Virginia, where we were honoring disabled veterans, wounded warriors, and helping them to cope with their wounds by learning how to fly fish. And one of the captains who had been badly wounded at my table essentially said exactly what that guy said. He essentially said, "Don't ever tell me about wars of choice again. Wars of choice make me sick." That's what a lot of veterans feel.
So is the record ever going to be clear, both in terms of the consequences of torture, or the folly of Iraq, the real incompetence of the Bush-Cheney and arguably the Cheney-Bush first term? My understanding is that they're pretty estranged. They don't really talk to each other. And Bush sort of woke up towards the end of his first term, realizing how much Cheney had essentially captured his own government. And you mentioned earlier that he shredded all the regulations. Is this history ever going to come out, do you think?
I think eventually, maybe 25 or 30 years, when all the moratoria come off, the classified documents and so forth. Well, let's just take the torture issue. The two-year project of the Constitution Project has revealed what happened, but they didn't have any access. They didn't have subpoena power, and they didn't have any access to the classified material, like, for example, the Senate Armed Services Committee did. The first thing that committee ought to do is release this classified information. They can redact sources and methods. That would not be difficult. Release this information to corroborate in a much more visceral, much more official and documented sort of way what the Constitution Project has done from the public sources. They won't do that, though, because then we've got war criminals. We've got war criminals at the highest level of the United States government.
Well, there's also a similar 6,000-page report based on CIA classified material that Senator Feinstein has with the Senate Select Intelligence Committee. Why don't they release a declassified version of that?
They could redact that too, protect sources and methods quite adequately, and let the American people see exactly what happened. Resounding answers to two questions were furnished by the Constitution Project's task force. One, did the United States torture? Absolutely it did. Two, was it authorized at the highest levels of the land? Yes. Well, domestic and international law says you won't do that upon penalties. Has anyone been punished other than the lower level people?
Well, Colonel Wilkerson, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thanks for having me, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Lawrence Wilkerson, who is a retired United States Army colonel and former chief of staff to United States Secretary of State Colin Powell. In 2005, he went public with his knowledge that Vice President Cheney had provided the guidance that led to America's torture disgrace at Guantanamo, Abu Ghraib, and elsewhere. Currently, he teaches courses at the College of William & Mary and George Washington University. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back joined by Joan Walsh, who will be talking about what's the matter with white people.
Idiot wind blowing in through the front door. Idiot wind blowing in from the back. Idiot wind blowing in from every crevice, every crack. Anybody want to tell it like it is to each other? Like you would to a sister or a brother. It could be said, cosmopolitan style.
You're nothing but a dirty, dirty old man. You do your thinking with a one-track mind. Keep talking about heaven, glory, but on your face is a different story. Clean up your rap.
Your story's getting dusty. Wash out your mouth, your lies are getting rusty. Can't believe nothing you say, 'cause I'm around and I see what you do.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Joan Walsh, editor-at-large of Salon.com and an MSNBC political analyst. She is a regular on Hardball with Chris Matthews, The Edge Show, Politics Nation, and a range of other MSNBC shows. Her latest book, just out in paperback, is What's the Matter with White People? Finding Our Way in the Next America. Welcome to Background Briefing, Joan Walsh.
Thank you, Ian.
And in the opening, I mentioned that we'd be talking about or discussing the domination of our politics by a minority of angry white men who have prevented sensible gun safety measures that 90% of Americans favor. Do you have an answer to this puzzlement?
Oh, if I did, Ian, we'd all be very lucky. I think one answer, though, really lies in the gerrymandering of the House, where you have Republicans who are going to be in Congress for life if they'd like to, unless they get a Tea Party challenge, and that's partially true in the Senate as well, that everyone is looking to their right flank. And it's also true for Democrats, that, you know, Democrats in red states, you know, Heidi Heitkamp, Mark Pryor, et cetera, the people who voted against, you know, the milquetoast, watered-down background checks, they are also looking to their right. They're not afraid of a left-wing pro-gun challenger when they come up for election next. They're afraid of either a right-wing Democrat or, you know, their Republican challenger.
But Joan, still the bill did pass by 54 votes, which is a majority in the Senate. But we know because it got nowhere because of the filibuster threshold. And that leads me to ask whether or not, since the Republicans Party is essentially a Southern party, and most of their senators are Southerners, is this a legacy then of Jim Crow, the ability of a minority to thwart a majority, the very mechanics of Jim Crow?
Well, I think it's slightly different mechanics, but it is a minority. You know, they've always been very good at wielding the power of our supposed democracy to thwart the majority, whether it's the African American majority in the South, or you know, large plurality in the South, or now nationally. I mean, you're right, and you know, the fact that Harry Reid didn't get filibuster reform done when he maybe could have, and the fact that the president probably didn't fight for it the way he should have, and Democrats didn't take that on as a cause. You know, supposedly they're always thinking about, well, what will happen to us when we're in a minority, and maybe we're going to want this back again. And I think that's ridiculous thinking. Think about the policies you need to keep the majority, rather than how you're going to thwart the other guy's agenda when you're in the minority. But you know, apparently both parties do it to some extent.
Well, presumably the Democrats are thinking of 2014, the midterms, where normally the party in the White House loses seats. Is that what's going on here?
I think that is what's going on here. And you saw the red state Democrats who did do the right thing, like John Tester of Montana. Many of them had just come through a tough reelection battle. So, you know, it tended to be people who were looking at 2014, but also then, you know, you've got Heidi Heitkamp who was just elected for the first time and had 6 years to live down in some way or out-organize the NRA if she'd cast a good vote for background checks. So it doesn't always line up with 2014, but yes, the fear of 2014 now drives everything.
Again, I'm speaking with Joan Walsh, editor-at-large of Salon.com and an MSNBC political analyst. She's a regular on Hardball with Chris Matthews, The Edge Show, Politics Nation, and a range of other MSNBC shows. Her latest book, just out in paperback, is What's the Matter with White People? Finding Our Way in the Next America. So given this, what the stakes are in 2014, and I think they go beyond just a regular Democrat versus Republican situation here, because this is really about ending gridlock, at least if that's the case the Democrats could make, because we do have a broken and paralyzed government. And the only way it will change is if we if the Democrats get enough people to get over the 60th threshold, assuming that they don't man up and do something about the filibuster usurpation. So if you can, if they can get more than 60 seats in the Senate and get a majority back in the House, maybe then they can get something done. Otherwise, it's completely bleak, isn't it?
It's fairly bleak, and but I think it's very unlikely that they're going to be able to do that. They have a lot of senators up for re-election. The House is not necessarily within their grip. So I think we're going to be living the way we are, roughly the way we are, for a while. But it would help if we had more Democrats who voted like populist Democrats and less like Republicans and were less enthralled either to Wall Street or the NRA. However, having said that, the Democrats can't do it alone. And the fact that you really are losing that, we've lost that old Northeastern moderate Republican. We've got Kelly Ayotte, who, again, cast a terrible vote on background checks and is hearing from her constituents. We've got, I guess, to some extent, Chris Christie. But we're losing moderate Republicans of all stripes and from all regions, and so that there's not any place that you can consider this. The center has moved so far to the right, and I think it's pulled the Democratic Party to some extent that way too.
Well, when you casting some pouring some cold water on the Democrats' chances to fix our broken government in 2014, which of course it goes against the conventions. Although Bill Clinton did actually pick up seats in his second term
in 1998. Yes, he did, and I think that was. That was a reaction both to the overreach of impeachment and the humiliation of Newt Gingrich. And so it is possible. It's possible for them to pick up seats. I don't mean to say that they can't.
It's just not likely.
It's not likely that they'll pick. They're not going to pick up a veto-proof majority, I don't think, unless the Republicans really do something deeply, even more deeply stupid than they've been doing.
Well, I brought this up because there was a hearing this week with Kathleen Sebelius, Secretary of Health and Human Services, where it became extremely evident that Democratic senators and also House members are very, very concerned about the rollout of so-called Obamacare. They're going to start the exchanges in October, and then by January the 1st of 2014, they're supposed to roll them out, and they're supposed to be up and running. And it looks as if, and a lot of these senators, Senator Cardin of Maryland, saying, first of all, Max Baucus, who's not exactly the best source, I don't think, but he gives him a failing grade and says this is just going to be a huge train wreck that's coming. This is a terrible possibility. I mean, the LA Times broke a story recently that said that in the law there's a tiny little trap that allows the big insurance companies to extend their existing policies for a whole year through 2014. So if this is true, which apparently it is, and I don't know how in God's name that ever got into the bill, this loophole, the big insurance companies could then cherry pick and keep their healthy customers and then dump the ones they don't want on this new exchange. And as Cardin is saying, is that he's got indications already that the insurance companies are going to raise their rates. So if Obamacare is rolled out in 2014 and the American consumer / voter sees their insurance premiums go up, isn't that going to play right into the Republicans' hands?
I'm very concerned about that, too. I think it's great that Max Baucus has emerged as a critic, since he probably single-handedly had more to do than any other Democrat with the way the bill turned out, and, with killing all of the progressive alternatives, whether it was public option or Medicare for all. He was, you know, the bottleneck and was constantly compromising with Republicans, only to, in the end, get no Republican support for the bill. So, you know, you really do have these Democrats who've been beholden to the insurance companies, you know, right up until the very end, slipping in exceptions. And, you know, in states like New York, where there is a stronger, I mean, California in general has a strong regulatory culture and a pro-consumer culture compared to most other states, but this is an area where California doesn't have the power. The state doesn't have the power to really reject rate increases, whereas in New York they have much more power. And, you know, so state by state, you're going to see all kinds of shenanigans by the insurance companies. And yes, it's going to be, when people are paying higher premiums, there's a real danger that they're going to be blaming Obamacare and the Democrats rather than crediting them with the decent things that the bill did.
And Joan Walsh, again, the author of What's the Matter with White People, Finding Our Way into the Next America. Just to back to, on the subject of angry white men, I saw the most extraordinary example of that the other day on television. There was this youngish-looking congressman from Arkansas, the crew cut, a Republican, a Tea Party guy, railing about how Obama didn't keep us safe with the Boston bomber and how Bush kept us safe. And this has been echoed. It's almost the Republican talking points. They echo all around Fox News amongst the punditry. Krauthammer is saying the same thing. Dana Perina is saying the same thing. So they're all, singing off the same hymnal there. But, you know, of course, they conveniently omit 9/11. I was just talking to Colonel Wilkerson about it, and he feels that Bush and Cheney actually have tremendous culpability, and they know it for reckless endangerment of the United States prior to 9/11. He also said something I'd never heard before, which is that both Bush and Cheney literally went missing for 40 minutes at that critical moment, and that Cheney had nothing to do with the shoot down of the plane. In fact, people were looking for him to find out what to do about this plane that was coming in from Pennsylvania.
I hadn't heard that either. That's very interesting. Well, yeah, I mean, and when you think about the way the whole country pulled together after 9/11 and Democrats really, you know, applauded the president and his approval ratings soared. I mean, I don't really like comparing Boston with 9/11 because it's really not in the same scope or scale in any way. You know, there's almost no comparison except that, you know, the two bombers may have been at least partly driven by, you know, Islamic radicalism, but in so many other ways, you know, it was much, this is no consolation to either, you know, the families who lost loved ones or the survivors who will be rebuilding their lives for a long time, but the scale was just, there's no comparison. And so the fact that we talk about them in the same breath is kind of crazy to me. But since we do, you know, the country pulled together and Democrats supported George Bush after 9/11. And the immediate crazy finger pointing that we're seeing, that we've seen since, you know, day two or three, is just a, you know, it's a measure of this hyper-partisanship and this, you know, Obama hatred that, you know, has made his life and his political possibilities really miserable. And I also, I've been having a lot of fun with the debate over are the Tsarnaev brothers white? Well, of course they're white. They are from the Caucasus and they are Caucasian. But even more, in a Boston Globe story last week about the poor, I guess, Chinese immigrant who they carjacked, Tamerlan made a joke about maybe the Chinese guy thought all whites look alike. So, you know, we want to cast them as other. We want to cast them as Muslim fundamentalist extremist radicals. We want to make them as scary and other as possible. When, you know, the more we find out about this story, they're really a hybrid with Islamic radicalism playing some role, and just kind of lumpen American alienation playing, you know, as large, if not a larger role.
So just in closing, though, John Walsh, then, is it possible, back to 2014, is it possible that the better angels of our nature will emerge in 2014 and a majority of Americans will recognize that people like this congressman spouting off about Bush keeping us safe and Obama not, and Ted Cruz, who the president last night at the correspondents' dinner made fun of, and the stuff that he says is just obscene and horrible and completely lunatic, and Rand Paul's had his share of saying crazy stuff, and you know, there's a derangement out there that you referred to. Is it possible that all this will be recognized, and that this guy that's trying to do a job can't get anything done because of these forces arrayed against him may get some sympathy?
It's possible. I mean, it's very possible. It's also possible that, you know, I'm an optimist, so I think it's possible. But I think that the forces of fear that, you know, the Republicans really have, since the 60s, been masters of using, or really since the 40s, since the debate over who lost China, and Truman supposedly lost China, and then Vietnam, you know, they've been really great at using the politics of fear to make voters think that Democrats mean to do them harm in some way. And so, you know, we're seeing a real resurgence of that. It's morphing slightly, but it's still there. And that, you know, I think that's going to be part of what plays out in 2014.
And do you think that the president can make a case? I don't think he is going to, but he should make a case that the reason the economy's not doing well is that they've stopped him at every turn, even going back to his original stimulus. So the question you have to ask is, did the Republicans thwart economic recovery out of ideology or to screw Obama?
I think it was very much both. And I think he did make that case fairly successfully in the 2012 elections. But, you know, there's probably diminishing returns on that particular argument to go, you know, when you have to go back to 2009. I think that Obama and the Democrats are going to be suffering from or benefiting from, you know, the question, what have you done for me lately? And they've got to make a case that they're continuing to do things against all odds, against incredible mm-hmm. Republican opposition in order to have a successful 2014.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Joan Walsh.
My pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Joan Walsh, who's editor-at-large of Salon.com and an MSNBC political analyst. She's a regular on Hardball with Chris Matthews, The Ed Show, Politics Nation, and a range of other MSNBC shows. Her latest book, just out in paperback, is What's the Matter with White People Finding Our Way in the Next America? This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. The headline.